Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, and my next guest, New York Times writer Andy Newman, spent a few days working as a courier for food delivery apps and came back with a story to tell about life on the front human lines in the modern tech economy. Apps like Uber Eats and DoorDash connect restaurants with New Yorkers in our homes and workplaces through e-commerce, yes, but for the army of riders making that convenience possible, life in the delivery lane is a lot more tense than most people have any idea of. Did you read this eye-opening article? It's called My Frantic Life as a Cab-Dodging, Tip-Chasing Food App Delivery Man. And you may have heard yesterday that the biggest food delivery app changed its pay policy after the story published. So we'll begin there. Hi, Andy. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks very much for having me.
And let's actually start with this breaking news. DoorDash changed its payment and tips policy after your story published. This policy, which outraged people when they saw it in your piece, how did it work?
Okay. So this is, I'm going to take a second to unpack this because people think, a lot of people are thinking, oh, DoorDash used to steal the workers' tips. Now they're not going to steal the workers' tips anymore. That's great. Yay, everybody. But it's so much more complicated than that. How this policy worked is one of those things that depends on your point of view, what it really means. So from the customer's point of view, it's terrible, right? I brought along your burrito here.
Oh, thank you.
Which I'm going to use as a prop.
Green salsa or red?
Green and red salsa.
Oh, good. I like it.
So here's the burrito. DoorDash tells me I will give you $7 to deliver a burrito to Brian, right? If Brian doesn't tip anything, we'll still give you the $7. If Brian tips $3, we'll also still give you the $7. Huh. And now we have Brian's tip. So from the customer's point of view, it's like you're trying to give $3 to me, the hardworking mm-hmm. burrito delivery guy, and instead DoorDash has it. And you're basically tipping this multi-billion dollar company. Here's your burrito. I hope you like it.
Oh, thank you.
So that's what it looks like.
Ooh,
from the customer.
It's still warm.
It's still hot. It's from Lupe's down the street. That's how it is from the customer's point of view.
I love Lupe's. Very old school.
And you're probably thinking, Andy should probably go work for a different app that doesn't steal his tips. But what if I told you that same burrito that DoorDash is giving me $7 to deliver to you, if I did that delivery for Uber Eats, they'd only give me $3, but they'd let me give the tip, let me keep the tip.
Mm-hmm.
So DoorDash is guaranteeing me $7, whether you tip or not. Uber Eats is saying, we're only going to give you $3. You get to keep the whole tip. But if Brian turns out to be a cheapskate, you're kind of screwed. So the way DoorDash spins it, it's like, we're giving you this pile of money to deliver Brian's burrito. If he doesn't tip you, you know, you're protected. And DoorDash, are you following me so far?
I'm following you so far. And one way to think about this is the ultimate prize for a journalist is writing a story that brings about policy change that's
right.
In the public interest. Your story did that in one day. And yet you're saying this is not a slam dunk victory.
It's not a slam dunk. And so here, and by the way, DoorDash is saying the whole thing about DoorDash is taking the tip that you gave Andy. What DoorDash is really saying is, yeah, maybe Andy doesn't get your tip directly, but all of you customers pooling your tips together, that's what allows us to offer Andy a little more money than those other apps that let him keep the tip. So in a way, Andy kind of is getting your tip. Now, from the point of view of the delivery guy, it's totally unclear. What matters is how much money they make altogether. And so what DoorDash decided yesterday is we will no longer kind of fold the tip into the money we give the delivery guy. We are going to give the delivery guy the whole tip, you know, spelled out clearly. And then when the customer puts $3 tip on the app, they know that the delivery guy is going to get $3 more than he otherwise would have, which sounds great. But this is kind of the crux of it. DoorDash, because the whole app industry, the whole gig economy, is not really governed by minimum wage laws because these people are considered contractors, not employees. Mm-hmm. DoorDash can pay whatever the hell it wants for these deliveries, and they could say, yes, we're going to give you 100% of the tips from now on. You'll get to keep it as a separate thing, but maybe we will adjust the base pay down to make up for it. And if you think about it, why would DoorDash do anything that's going to end up increasing their labor costs? Right?
Is that what they're doing? They're adjusting the base pay down?
Well, so they haven't said that they will do that, but it seems logical that they probably will. And some delivery guys are saying, DoorDash used to steal our tips. Now they're not stealing them. That's great. Other delivery guys are saying, wait a second, I like that system. It meant that I got an okay amount of money, even if the customer didn't tip. We're going to have less consistent wages, and they're going to reduce that minimum guarantee, and we'll just be scrounging for tips a lot more, and we may end up getting screwed. And it just depends on how much DoorDash pays. If DoorDash decides to keep paying that $7 and let you keep the tip, that would be fantastic. But they're not going to do that. I almost guarantee it.
And I want to get to other aspects of your article, like why you call it a game of real life speed chess played across the treacherous grid of the city. Now that you had this experience being a food app delivery person, I also want to open up the phones for people who have actually done this for a living. Any current or former food delivery people want to call up and talk about the pay issue that we've raised first? How do you think delivery people should be paid? 212-433-WNYC. First priority is going to go to anybody who's ever done this for a living. 212-433-9692 with Andy Newman from The Times. And also talk about, the physical experience, listeners, of being a delivery person. 212-433-9692. But to just stay on what you've been talking about so far, do you have an opinion about what the best way to pay delivery people would be? Because I hear this double-edged sword of the tip being in effect stolen because really they're getting a flat fee per delivery and then the restaurant keeps the tip. But also if other restaurants don't even pay the flat fee and you're only dependent on the tip when you don't even get the minimum wage, that's not so great either. You know that the progressive thing in restaurants these days for the wait staff and the kitchen staff is to go tipless. And they just, divide more evenly between and among all the workers. So is there a best practice here?
The hard thing in this, right, would be mandating a living wage for these workers because they don't work really regular hours. They have the option under the whole system to either take an order or not take an order. So it's even hard to say when somebody's hour of work begins and ends. But unless there's some kind of regulatory framework that makes sure that these guys get paid at least a minimal amount, it's always going to be this situation where the apps hold all the cards and they can basically do whatever they want.
We'll continue with Andy Newman and your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Andy Newman from the New York Times, whose article this week is My Frantic Life as a Cab Dodging, Tip Chasing Food App Delivery Man. And I think one of the things that I certainly didn't know until I read your piece was how much decision making and sort of high stakes decision making, both for your personal safety as well as your pocketbook, goes into being a delivery person. We might casually think, those of us who are on the ordering side of this, the person works for that Chinese takeout place a few blocks away and they just go and come back and go and come back. But your article starts, I had just started my lunch shift when the phone pinged. Uber Eats, pick up at Cochina del Sur on West 38th Street, five blocks away. Great. Seconds later, my phone ponged. Different sound. Postmates, another delivery app, pick up two orders at Shake Shack on Broadway and 36th. And here's the here's the punchline. Information was limited. The Uber Eats app doesn't tell you where the delivery is going until you pick it up. I could not know what the Postmates job would pay. So does that mean Uber Eats will tell you how much money you get, but not how long it's going to take you to make the delivery because they won't tell you where it is? Postmates will tell you where it is, but they won't tell you how much you'll get?
The Postmates, you can kind of have a sense of how much you'll get from Postmates, but you don't know anything for sure, basically, in these situations. And so that, that was the big surprise for me, too, when I was reporting it, because the reason I wrote about this industry is because the restaurant delivery has been around forever, right? You have the guy who works for the Chinese restaurant, who, by the way, only gets paid like $40 a day plus tips. And he does all the orders for that restaurant and doesn't have to do anything except what he's told. With the apps, you have to decide with each job, am I going to take this order or not? And then what most people do is they work for multiple apps so they can make more money. And then you have two apps giving you orders at the same time. And you have to make this calculation in the middle of traffic with, you know, sirens and jackhammers and pedestrians and cops and everything all around you. You're riding a bike and you're literally tapping the thing on your phone and trying not to get into an accident. And it was crazy.
Jimmy in Englewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jimmy.
How you doing? First of all, this is one of the reasons why I listen to NPR and your show, Brian, because I, as a DoorDash delivery guy, and I signed up for Postmates, and I did it like a couple times, and I wasn't making any money that I wanted to. Uh-huh. Like, me as an independent contractor, how do I get this information? DoorDash doesn't shoot me an email saying, hey, we changed our policy, or we're going to, you know, all I know is I'm getting XYZ money for the delivery. I get to choose. I know the distance I'm traveling, and I make my decision based on that. But like the writer said, I don't know if this is a win-win for me. I'm going to make less money on the front end and then get all the tips on the back end. At the end of the day, I just wanted to get paid, and I want to be I want it to be fair. But when I make a delivery, people always often ask me, "Do you want the chip in cash or should I go through the app?" And I'm thinking, give the people, go through the app. I figure I'm getting all the money. I never knew that I wasn't getting all the money, and I don't think that's fair.
Jimmy, thank you. Do you have any advice for Jimmy?
As far as whether this is going to work out well for you or not, like I said, it depends on what they do to the overall pay structure. In the old days, you should have told the customers to tip you in cash because then that's money that DoorDash wouldn't have pocketed. But going forward, people can tip you on the app, and supposedly you really will get all of it. So it's going to depend a lot more on how your tips are in the future, I think, is the answer.
Jimmy, stay safe out there and call us again. Leiter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? To start off, I work for DoorDash, and I just tried to sign up for Caviar because DoorDash, when I started off with DoorDash, they said $7 they pay on top of tips. All right, that's fine and dandy. By the time May and June hit, everyone started to crowd in from Bronx, Brooklyn, and Queens, so it's very difficult to get a schedule shift in. And then on top of that, I started to like really look into the payments that I'm getting, because after you make the delivery and you swipe delivered and whatnot, they ask you, how was your delivery experience? Good, bad, and they also tell you how much you earned and where the money came from. Oftentimes, I was expecting that $7 was coming from DoorDash on top of whatever tip that I was making. So if I seen $7, I just assumed that the customer didn't tip me. Lo and behold, the customer would tip me, and they would drop down their base pay to about like maybe $1 or $2. And I felt that was completely wrong, and that they're really just sneaking, they're pinching the tips away from the people. So,
Andy, are there ways that people like our first two callers, Leiter, who's working for DoorDash in Manhattan, Jimmy, who's doing it in Englewood, can band together and use their, you know, worker power in some way?
I don't know about that. I don't have too much faith in the apps responding to worker concerns. I mean, one thing that does happen is if all the DoorDash workers quit, then DoorDash will say, oh, we have to change our policies to attract more drivers again.
And Lido, thank you.
But that's not going to happen either.
You stay safe out there, too. I want you to say something about the danger of this job, because you have a stat in your article that nearly a third of delivery cyclists missed work because of an on-the-job injury last year alone.
Yeah, that was also another surprise to me. There was a guy who runs an advocacy group called the Biking Public Project, and he talked to like 150 riders, and he asked them this exact question: do you ever get injured? Do you ever have to miss work for injuries? I myself did it for 27 hours without getting injured, but I considered myself very lucky, because as dangerous as it is to ride a bike on the streets of New York, if you're doing it for a living as one of these delivery drivers, you're going to ride really aggressively because time is money and you're just barely scraping by. And these guys really do things that are a little bit, you know, excessive, though they actually cause much fewer pedestrian injuries than people might think, than the mayor might think. But yeah, people get hurt all the time.
Did you use the fully electric bikes, controversial as they
yes,
are?
Yes, I used a completely illegal bike, although there were two modes. There's the pedal assist mode, which is legal, and then there's the throttle mode where you just go vroom and the bike zooms off. And so I always rode it in pedal assist, almost always, so that the cops wouldn't say, you know, I was probably also protected by my little bubble of white privilege that I just looked like a white guy on a bike and not, you know, a delivery guy.
Did you ride in the bike lanes, sidewalks, or only with other motor vehicles?
I rode in the bike lanes when there were bike lanes. I didn't ride in the bike lanes when they were blocked by cars or buses or cops. I rode on the sidewalks occasionally. I rode the wrong way occasionally, although I tried to walk when I was on a one-way street. But if you want to, the way I rationalized it, if you want to do this job the way the people who actually do it, you have to, you know, maybe break the same laws that they break.
Damon in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Andy Newman from the New York Times. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment that there's a lot of other companies as well that are also taking people tips. I have noticed when talking to other people working for Postmates that the tips were being taken. And my suggestion to other delivery people is just to talk to as many people as possible, and you'll find the better companies that pay better and don't take tips.
That's a good policy. I know that Postmates got into trouble. They had to pay out a settlement for tip stealing, I believe. So yeah, it's when the customer is giving the money to the app, it's very hard to track what happens to it.
We haven't mentioned Grubhub or Seamless, which are so ubiquitous out there.
Yeah, Grubhub and Seamless together, I think, make up about 3/4 of the New York market. And so I didn't ride for them because they weren't accepting riders when I was doing it. I did talk to some veteran riders, and the veteran riders were telling me that the ones you want to ride for are Grubhub, Seamless, and also Caviar, that they tend overall, I mean, there's problems with those too. They tend overall to make out the best with those, although Grubhub supposedly just lowered its pay rates too, so people are not too happy about that. The maddening thing is that these apps are constantly adjusting the pay rates because they need to for whatever fiscal reason, and then the delivery guys are at the mercy of the system, and they're left scrambling, even trying to figure out how much they're getting paid.
In our last minute, you want to put this into an even broader context for us? Because you write, I learned up close how the high-tech era of on-demand everything is transforming some of the lowest tech, lowest status, low-wage occupations, creating both new opportunities and new forms of exploitation.
I said that.
I think I read that.
No, I did write that. I mean,
You're a good writer. Take credit.
I'm not sure how to add anything to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the bigger picture, it's an industry where there's very, very little regulation. And until governments figure out and or get the willpower to figure out a way to regulate what they're doing, they're just going to be kind of finding new ways to screw people.
I actually wonder, we just have a few seconds, but whether the backlash against the e-bikes might actually wind up bringing more sympathy through more attention in general to the delivery people who are sort of invisible in society in general. But now everybody's talking about their needs. In fact, I wonder if that's why you wrote this article in the first place.
It is not why I wrote the article, but it's a side benefit.
Andy Newman from The Times. Do read his article this week called My Frantic Life as a Cab Dodging, Tip Chasing, Food App Delivery Man. Thank you so much.
Enjoy your burrito, Brian.
I'm going to share it. I'm going to break it into 15 different pieces. I don't know what I'm going to do, but you gave me an actual warm burrito delivered.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and if you haven't heard yet, Boris Johnson, one of the loudest voices for Brexit in the lead up to that 2016 vote, has been selected this morning as the head of Britain's Conservative Party, which means he will be the next prime minister. To some in the UK, this is not that different than Donald Trump being elected president here. So Brits, if you're listening over there, or anyone with connections to the UK who's listening over here, we'll have a guest and a call in now for you to sound off and help everyone else understand this turn of events. What do you think? Do you support Boris Johnson? Why or why not? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or what would you like to ask our next guest, who's here to help us make sense of all this? Yasmin Serhan, who joins us from London. She covers Europe for The Atlantic. 212-433-WNYC with questions for her. And thanks for joining us, Yasmin. Hello from New York.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And be patient for a minute, actually for 2.5 minutes, because we're going to play for our listeners an excerpt from Johnson's victory speech after being elected leader around 7 o'clock New York time this morning.
It is we Conservatives who have had the best insights, I think, into human nature. And in the best insights into how to manage the jostling sets of instincts in the human heart. And time and again, it is to us that the people of this country have turned to get that balance right between the instincts to own your own house, your own home, to earn and spend your own money, to look after your own family, good instincts, proper instincts, noble instincts, and the equally noble instinct to share and to give everyone a fair chance in life and to look after the poorest and the neediest and to build a great society. And on the whole, in the last 200 years, it is we Conservatives who have understood best how to encourage those instincts to work together in harmony to promote the good of the whole country. And today, at this pivotal moment in our history, we again have to reconcile two sets of instincts, two noble sets of instincts, between the deep desire for friendship and free trade and mutual support in security and defence between Britain and our European partners, and the simultaneous desire, equally deep and heartfelt, for democratic self-government in this country. And of course, there are some people who say that they're irreconcilable, and it just can't be done. And indeed, I read in my Financial Times this morning, devoted reader that I am, seriously, it's a great, 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 great British brand. I read in my Financial Times this morning that there are no incoming leader has ever faced such a daunting set of circumstances, it said. Well, I look at you this morning and I ask myself, do you look daunted? Do you feel daunted? I don't think you look remotely daunted to me. And I think that we know that we can do it, and that the people of this country are trusting in us to do it, and we know that we will do it. And we know the mantra of the campaign that has just gone by. In case you've forgotten it, you probably have. It is deliver Brexit, unite the country, and defeat Jeremy Corbyn.
Boris Johnson there in the process of becoming Prime Minister of the UK. 2.5 minutes of his victory speech this morning after being elected leader of the Conservative Party, which will shortly promote him officially to the position of Prime Minister. Our guest is Yasmin Serhan, who joins us from London covering Europe for The Atlantic. You know what struck me first, Yasmin, about that speech? Unlike Donald Trump, if people are saying he's the Donald Trump of the UK, He was giving respect to two sets of what he described as noble instincts, and really one more liberal and one more conservative.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, you definitely hear it, especially in that last bit, talking about these two noble, deeply heartfelt instincts. He's clearly trying to take this moment to sort of unite the country. I mean, he already has the bulk of the party behind him, and the Tory membership being of a particular, I guess, part of the British electorate. But yeah, you could clearly hear there that he was trying to sort of bridge that gap a bit. I mean, you will hear this a lot in the coming days, and as you've said, you've heard it already. There will be a lot of comparisons between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, but you know, I actually do think that they're two quite different individuals. I mean, they have a lot of superficial similarities. You know, the interesting hair, the high profile personal lives. But you know, they are fundamentally, you know, two different individuals. I mean, I think first and foremost, what jumps out to me is that whereas Trump's always positioned himself as kind of the outsider coming into Washington and shaking things up, Boris is very firmly entrenched in the British elite. He's been in British politics for quite a while. He was foreign secretary before this. He was even London mayor before that. So, you know, I do think beyond those superficial similarities, we are dealing with two very different men.
With respect to Brexit and in comparison to Trump, if we can say that Trump, his modus operandi is to exploit xenophobia to the max, does Boris Johnson do that too? Is that part of his Brexit rhetoric?
I mean, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily part of his Brexit rhetoric, though Boris Johnson has, like Trump, kind of, you know, said very controversial and unbecoming things of you know, a leader of a party in a country. I mean, he had a very gaffe-prone tenure as foreign secretary in which he said things that, you know, have insulted people. I mean, his famous comment about Muslim women who wear the burqa, which he likened to letterboxes. He said all
he
sorts
what?
Of things.
He likened a burqa to letterboxes, mailboxes?
He likened women who wear the niqab or the burqa to letterboxes in the UK, like mailboxes, effectively. It was one of kind of his more controversial, insulting statements he's made. But I mean, as far as using that sort of rhetoric with regard to Brexit, I mean, he doesn't really talk about immigration as much, not in the way Donald Trump does, certainly. His big push for Brexit is about, you know, basically having Britain take back control and, you know, strike off and make trade deals with the rest of the world, including the United States. It's very much one about sovereignty, I think, more so than you know, stopping people from coming into the country. Though that there certainly is an element of that, I think, in the Brexit rhetoric. We certainly saw that in the referendum, pushed by other elements, I think, more so than Boris.
All right. Listeners, who among you with ties to the UK wants to weigh in on or ask a question about the elevation of Boris Johnson on his way to being the next prime minister, officially as of this morning, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Yasmin Serhan, covering Europe for The Atlantic. She's in London. And Marie in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Hello.
What would you like to say?
I mean, I feel equally embarrassed on either side at the moment. You know, we have now somebody as Prime Minister of the UK who does not have the poise that you would look for. Just like I feel the, you know, president of this country at the moment just does not have the behavior that you look to show your children in that office. It's just I'm kind of embarrassed on either side, and I can't understand how the UK has got to this, but I couldn't understand how we got to it over here either. It's just mortifying.
For people over here unfamiliar with Boris Johnson, in what ways would you say he doesn't have that poise or dignity?
He's very well known for being on a panel show in England called Have I Got News For You, where he showed himself as being completely out of touch with everyday life, and not even in a good way, as a blustering, bumbling person. And I'm sure part of it is an act that he puts on, you know, a persona that he feels works well for him. And maybe he'll stun us all, but I had hoped the same for Trump, and that did not happen here. So, you know, my hope is fading every day.
Thank you for your call. Call us again. Yasmin, you wrote a piece 2 weeks ago titled The Selectorate Picking Britain's Prime Minister. Who are the selectorate as compared to the electorate?
Yes, the Selectorate are basically the Tory Party or the Conservative Party members who are, you know, dues-paying, card-carrying members of the Conservative Party. Because though ostensibly, as you say, this leadership contest was about choosing Britain's next prime minister, in actual fact, it was about choosing the next leader of the Conservative Party, the party that just so happens to be in power. So it was a decision that ultimately fell to the Conservative Party's members. And that's actually a very small sliver of the broader British electorate. Less than 1% of people were eligible to vote in this contest. And an even smaller percentage of that actually ended up doing so. I think about a bit over 80%, I want to say maybe 83 or 84% of, I'd have to double check the number, but actually voted among Conservative Party members. So it really is a group of within the British electorate that's quite small, and one that isn't necessarily representative of the broader electorate, as I mentioned, or as I covered in my piece.
So would that be like as if our system here was after we elected Congress, the party that had the majority, the voters who were registered Democrats or registered Republicans, whichever party had the majority, those registered Democrats or registered Democrat or registered Republicans would then go vote again for the leader of the party, and that leader would become president?
Somewhat, yeah, it's kind of similar. But yeah, I mean, crucially, it's worth mentioning that, you know, all the parties function like this. If it were reverse and it was the Labour Party that was having a leadership contest and they were in power,
yeah,
the decision would fall to Labour Party members.
Right.
But yeah, it is an interesting way of doing things. And it does make it as such that, you know, particularly in scenarios like these where the country is kind of watching, but not everyone feels like they're taking part.
But only 1% of Britain's population is registered Tories?
Less than, yeah. I mean, it's the population or the percentage of the population that tends to be registered members of parties tends to be pretty small as it is. And those who are card-carrying conservatives tend to be older. They tend to be white men. They tend to be wealthier. They tend to live in the southern part of England. So, yeah, it is a really small sliver.
212-433-WNYC. And Peter in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you doing?
Good. So I'm good, I'm good. I'm actually driving, but never mind. I'm like a dentist. But I just wanted to say that I'm a baby boomer. I've been in the States 30 years, and I, you know, my generation grew up with a kind of liberal world order view. And now that's under attack. I follow three countries closely, Brazil, U.S., and Britain. So we have Bolsonaro in Brazil. We have Trump in the USA. And now we're about to elect Boris Johnson, yes. So basically, I guess my comment is, you know, the whole world that we grew up with is under attack. And it's like some of the other callers said, it's a bit of an embarrassment. I mean, I can't believe how Boris Johnson, who is a bit of a clown, could become the Prime Minister of the UK. And
but considering
and it's not
really
that this an election, is it? It's not an election because the Tory Party, about 150,000 mainly white elderly male people, have actually selected him. It wasn't a real election. There should have been an election after May decided to resign.
Peter, since you think about this and you follow it in three countries, you said, U.S., which has Trump, Brazil, which has Bolsonaro, the U.K., which is getting Boris Johnson. And it's embarrassing, yes, to people who grew up believing in the liberal world order, as you call it. But it must also represent a failure of the liberal world order to deliver on some of its promises that so many people are turning away. Have you thought about why or what the failure is?
Well, yes, I have actually, and global. I mean, I'm part of the whole globalization thing. I work in IT. I've been working with people in India and all around the world for 25 years, and you know, it's with a lot of jobs have taken away. Also, you know, industry, and I mean, I voted for Bernie. I think Bernie had a kind of he had his thing on the pulse about that in the last election in the States. So. That's part of what's going on. And I think, you know, Bernie Sanders would have actually probably possibly beaten Trump in the last election.
Peter, thank you very much for your call. Gavin in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gavin.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Long-time listener. And as an Englishman living in New York, I've seen the rise of Trump, and I think Boris is being compared to he's an English Trump. And my point being that unlike Trump, who hasn't been tested yet with a financial disaster or international crisis, I think Boris is walking into a cataclysmic financial disaster with Brexit, and he will oversee also the dissolution of the United Kingdom. You're going to have a Scottish referendum vote. You've got major problems with the Irish northern-southern border. He's a buffoon like Mr. Trump, but he's going to be shown up for such because he's going to be tested incredibly from the get-go, and he will summarily fail.
The prediction of failure from Gavin in Manhattan. Gavin, thank you very much. Still with us is Yasmin Serhan from The Atlantic in London. Yasmin, that's part of certainly the people who fear Brexit. Part of what they fear is that it will cause an economic disaster in Britain. Can you lay that out for us in a little more fullness?
Indeed, yeah. I mean, an economic disaster is one of the many concerns. I mean, overall, there's just, I mean, fundamentally, at the end of the day, Britain leaving the EU is essentially like dissolving a 40-plus year marriage. To do so with a deal in place, one that, you know, takes into account citizens' rights, the Irish border, the money that is owed, and all the litany of other issues from, you know, from defense and security cooperation and all those sorts of things. I mean, with a deal, it seems quite feasible. But without one, crucially, people fear that, you know, that there will be economic hurt on both sides of the channel, that, you know, that both sides would effectively have to scramble to take care of even seemingly, you know, seemingly standard issues such as getting food across the border and access to medicines and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, yeah, there is a lot of concern about the impact that a no-deal Brexit would have. Crucially, Boris Johnson has said that he still believes that he can get a deal over the line before Halloween. But he has also said that barring the EU's willingness to, say, move and renegotiate a deal, all these things they have so far said they would not do, that barring that he would consider a no-deal exit. But he's kind of given voters two messages. He has said, do or die, I will take Britain out of the EU by Halloween. But also that the chances of a no deal are slim to none. So, I mean, the next few months will be kind of voters' opportunities to see which direction he's going to go in.
On Johnson's do or die quote, the last thing people might be expecting right now is that I'm going to read a poem on the air. But do or die out of Boris Johnson's mouth originates from a poem about a failed military action involving the British cavalry during the Crimean War in 1854. This is the famous Charge of the Light Brigade by Alfred Tennyson. And the relevant part goes, forward, the Light Brigade. Was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply. Theirs not to reason why. Theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Yikes, that's what Boris Johnson is quoting.
My colleague Tom McTagg actually wrote a brilliant piece on that and kind of the British tendency to glorify defeat as a way of you know, seemingly trying to tackle this Brexit conundrum. But yeah, I mean, it is quite telling, and it's scary. You know, many people are concerned about it, obviously. You have businesses that have been concerned for quite a while. You have European citizens based here in the UK who have been living in somewhat of a limbo for the past few years. So yeah, I mean, it's really uncertain. But the thing, crucially, with Boris Johnson is that no one really knows who he is or where he stands. I mean, he has big views on Brexit, obviously, but he also quite famously wrote two op-eds ahead of announcing which side he was going to take in the referendum. And he obviously ultimately decided to go with supporting the Leave campaign. But I think what voters and people are crucially waiting now is to see whether he toes the line and tries to take a more measured approach and tries to find a way to get a deal, or if he decides to go full speed ahead on no deal. So I think, you know, right now, in this period, as he assembles his cabinet, as he kind of puts things together, that's what people will be looking out for.
We have 20 seconds, 30 seconds left. Is there a solution to the Northern Ireland problem?
I mean, no. I mean, there's fundamentally, I think, with all things Brexit, everything is kind of, nothing has changed, to quote Theresa May. I mean, he seems the same parliamentary arithmetic. He faces the same red lines from the EU. That includes the Irish border. So, no, I mean,
where Northern Ireland would have to leave the EU with Britain, but the rest of Ireland would stay in, and then there would be a border all over again, like the bad old days.
Right, which historically is quite sensitive, as you know. So, I mean, you know, barring technological solutions that don't yet exist, I don't see how there is anything really new here. I mean, crucially, Boris Johnson will face the same challenges that Theresa May has left behind. So we'll have to wait and see how he takes on that challenge.
Well, Yasmin, there's nothing left to say except forward.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for your deep knowledge of this. Yasmin Serhan covers Europe for The Atlantic and joined us from London.
Some bike lanes in my neighborhood. I'll gather up my cycling friends. The transportation committee of the community board will hear our great idea.
So, you say you want a bike lane. Well, yesterday, City Council Speaker Corey Johnson was here and promised more money next year for protected bike lanes. The mayor, by the way, on our program this morning, would not make that same commitment. But where will they go, and how do you even get the painted on kind for a scary street on your cycling route? That's what WNYC's Shamita Basu tried to find out for We the Commuters, the transit project from WNYC and Gothamist, and our wonderful composer slash receptionist extraordinaire Joseph Young set it all to music, as you just heard a little of. We will hear more of a song later. Shamita joins me now to talk about what's in the next few lines of the song and what else she's learned during Bike Week at We the Commuters. Hey, Shamita.
Hey, Brian.
That's a great song Joe did, but let's add a little context before we hear the whole thing. The next line of the song that I was talking over starts the transportation committee of the community board. So just like that, we're in the weeds, we're in hyper-local city government land. So
yes.
Tell me how the community board, its transportation committee, and the Department of Transportation that actually installs the bike lanes and ultimately chooses where to put them work together.
Yeah, so this is interesting. There's a lot of soft power at play here, Brian. So the community boards, which exist in it, there are 59 of them throughout our city. They have, a lot of them have a transportation committee, most of them do. And the transportation committee is the one that gets together and hears issues like bike lane proposals, anything that might affect the streets. So the DOT, the transportation department of the city, is actually required to bring any proposals that they have for new bike lanes and present them to the community board. They're required to. It's codified. It's in the city council law. It is actually a requirement. But they're not actually required to listen to the community board. I mean, and by that, I mean the community board gets to vote on the proposal. The DOT comes, they present it, they give their reasoning, and then the council, the committee, gets to vote. Their vote actually has no real say on whether the DOT will move forward with the plans.
Like a lot of things, the community boards are advisory.
They are. It's an advisory role. It is a voluntary role. No one gets paid for being on their community board. But the DOT, from having talked to some people who work there, they value the input from the community board members. And of course, these are open to the public meetings, so anyone can go and say their part. I think they're capped at a minute at most of these meetings. Otherwise, it goes on for a while. But the Department of Transportation, when I spoke to some folks who work there, they said, these meetings are crucial because they see the people who attend as experts in their own neighborhood. They know how it works. They walk around the streets. They drive around the streets. They use them.
And they're the most politically active at the neighborhood level.
They tend to be. That's right. So when I spoke to someone who worked at the DOT, they were like, we also take it with a grain of salt. We know that community boards and the people who serve on them are not always representative of who lives in that neighborhood. They're mostly representative of who has time to invest in being a voluntary advisory person in their community and who feels the strongest. So that tends to bring out some of the strongest characters.
Sounds like callers to talk shows. So listeners, have you worked to add a bike lane? Do you want more information on how to do it? Maybe somebody listening right now is a community board member yourself who has been through this on one side or the other. I mean, conversely, have you worked to defeat a bike lane? There is a lot of neighborhood opposition when they're proposed, as well as neighborhood support. So call and tell us a story or ask Shamita Basu a question at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And just as an example, here's a clip of the Upper West Side Community Board meeting where they were voting on the protected bike lane along Central Park West, and the Department of Transportation representative unveils the plan.
What we've done here is we've eliminated parking on the east side of Central Park West. The whole...
And that lane got approved, didn't it?
It did. It did later in that meeting. And I know that you heard applause in the room, but there were also plenty of people in the room who were not pleased to hear that. Not only did they eliminate parking on the east side of Central Park West, it was about 400 parking spots, they estimated. So that did not go over well to some of the folks in the room, especially those who have a car and were already talking about how difficult it is to park in that neighborhood. So these community board meetings, I mean, if you haven't been to a community board meeting, you got to go to one. I mean, it's like, it's local theater and it's free and you get to be a part of it if you want to. But it's also, it's where all the people who really care about what's going on in your community are, and they go to voice their opinion. So it's actually, it's really interesting to see what happens in them.
That clip from the Upper West Side Community Board meeting was of Ted Wright. He's the Bicycle and Greenway Program Director at the DOT at Community Board 7's meeting. Here's a clip. Well, you did get some criticism of the fact that community boards even have a role in this. This is Bay Ridge Bike Lane advocate Brian Hedden.
This is how ordinary citizens are supposed to be able to interface with the government, be able to have their concerns heard by different agencies, politicians, city hall, et cetera, et cetera. And instead of having that interface, that friendly interface with your city government, you just end up with this collective of 59 little city halls that you have to fight in addition to actual city hall.
So what's the context there, Shamita?
Well, it seems like for most of the advocates that I spoke to, they really describe their interactions with the community board over the situation of proposing a new bike lane as being one where they're really facing off. There, a lot of people that I spoke to were met with a lot of resistance when they go to their community boards, and it really depends on what's happening in different neighborhoods. So, for example, in Brian's neighborhood, I spoke to a few people who were involved in advocating there and they had gone to these community board meetings, and they described that their sense of it was that the community board members largely viewed people who bike as more liberal, as more left-leaning, and perhaps more members of the community board lean the other way, are more conservative in their politics. And so there was actually a bit of a political clash that was bearing out there in terms of which side was choosing which side of this debate, of the bike debate. In other neighborhoods, it may not be that way. I spoke to one person, Calista De Jesus, who lives in Flatbush, and she described her community board as being mostly black and brown folks, skewing kind of older, and a lot of them drive cars. So she, as a young woman of color, brought a lot of people of color to those community board meetings to show, hey, there are people of color who live in this neighborhood who bike and who could benefit from having bike lane infrastructure.
Desmond in Crown Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Desmond.
Good morning, Brian, and thank you for taking my call. First things first, I'm a community board member, but the opinions I express no way reflect the community board.
There you
are. That said, I'm a member of my board for more than 8 years. I'm on the Transportation Committee, and I've watched the things that have happened. There's a strong current in the city to reduce the number of cars, and that was initiated by the mayor who left the city and left us in the worst transportation nightmare when he refused to allow his aides to invoke transportation plowing, snow plowing. The city was frozen for 3 weeks. That said, community board members are appointed by borough presidents. We are non-salaried. We typically are people who are longtime residents in our communities. and we're non-salaried, but we can be fined by the Conflict of Interest Board for thousands of dollars. In spite of that, we still take our time, non-salaried, and weigh in on the issues in mm-hmm. our community. My community is Crown Heights. It's had been extremely minority, and through gentrification, it has changed. It is becoming more diverse and more economically upward. There's a tremendous pressure to have more bikes, but at the same time, the city Department of Planning and the transportation basically doesn't want to listen to the people. The bike lanes have become paramount, but basic transportation issues have been put on the back burner.
So are you an opponent of bike lanes in your neighborhood and see them as a sign of gentrification that's not in the community's interest?
I see the proliferation of bike lanes in my particular community, which was by Mayor Bloomberg. The street that I live on was called the Grand Central Parkway of Biking, which was Bergen Street. And they've since come and added more blocks specifically to support bike lanes. But then it changes parking patterns and alternate side patterns tremendously. And so what happens is that it creates a tremendous amount of stress on the people who drive. As the lady said mm-hmm. about the other board, a lot of the people who have cars are senior people who came up in a time when it was a privilege, which they mm-hmm. earned and pay for mm-hmm. to have a car.
Desmond, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you for your story and all that context. And Shamita, how much does Desmond reflect, I don't know if it's fair to say, one side of what you hear at a lot of community board meetings about bike lanes?
Yeah, it sounds like what Desmond is saying is fairly similar to what I heard from Calista De Jesus, who was advocating for a bike lane, as I mentioned, in Flatbush. She lives in Prospect Lefferts Gardens, and the way that she described her community board as being comprised of mostly people who have a car, who drive a car, and who are concerned about parking being taken away from them. I should note that bike lanes don't always mean that parking needs to be taken away. It really depends on the street. But also to the point that Calista was making and to the point of gentrification, really. Calista was saying how she'd been hearing from her board members that they'd never had a need for bike lanes in the past, and this has to do with new white gentrifiers coming into the neighborhood and changing it. And what Calista did as part of her rallying efforts was actually she stood outside and she encouraged other people to take pictures of people on bikes in the neighborhood and just to have a visual representation of people of color, immigrants, delivery workers, people who are clearly on a bike, who aren't just white gentrifiers, to make a case for why it really is people in the neighborhood.
Elizabeth in the East Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Yeah, so I would agree with that. I think it's too easy to cast it as white gentrifiers versus everyone else. Let's remember that bike lanes actually make it safer, also for pedestrians, for delivery people, for everyone, that we can change the culture of it. I spend a lot of time advocating in these meetings, and I wish there were a way to kind of streamline the process. When we were advocating for bike lanes on 29th and 26th Street, those literally cover three or four community boards, which means often two to three or even four meetings to get an approval. And what you see in these meetings is, on the one hand, yes, there are some people who are very afraid of losing their parking spot. And on the other hand, you've got advocates talking about friends of theirs who've been killed on that stretch of road. So parking spots sometimes versus lives saved.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. Alexa in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alexa.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm also a Queens Community Board 6 member, and what I'm saying is not reflecting the board, but I am a cyclist local in Forest Hills, and Queens Boulevard has been a real flagship project of the mayor in his Vision Zero, restructuring of how streets are run in New York. And it was a four-phase project. The Queens Community Board 6 voted for the Section 3 from the LIE to Yellowstone, and then actually voted against. I was one of the four votes, but it was voted against for the Section 4 from Yellowstone to Union Turnpike. But it was just an advisory vote, and the mayor's office and DOT assured us that it would still go through. But that vote was last year. Apparently, construction was supposed to start a year ago in July 2018, and we're still waiting with no real updates. And the streets are really unsafe. Queens Boulevard is a major thoroughfare that connects a lot of areas in Queens, as you know. And, you know, we're waiting here for any updates.
Do you know anything about the particular case, Shamita?
I wish I did, Alexa. And I know I've heard from so many other advocates who've shown up to meetings after meetings and members of community boards like yourself who end up then having to chase down the DOT and follow up and send their millionth email saying, so what is going on? And what I've heard on the DOT end is that sometimes there are ongoing feasibility studies that they're still doing. And, you know, sometimes it also just gets caught up in the many years long process of bureaucracy that is getting anything done in this city.
Alexa, I'm curious in your experience how contentious it's been and how contentious it is with your neighbors, because we looking at our caller board right now, it's a perfect example of it. We get calls like yours where people feel so strongly that this is the right thing to do. And we get at least an equal number of calls from people who are saying, for a variety of reasons, please, no more bike lanes in my neighborhood.
Yeah, it is definitely contentious. The first, you know, like I said, Section 3 was voted overwhelmingly for the bike lane to go in from that first section, and parking spots were removed. And, you know, the community was really upset about kind of what happened after that. And I think that there was some confusion with some stores changing, you know, going out of business and then being blamed erroneously on the bike lanes going in and the lack of parking. But, you know, as a cyclist who lives here in Central Queens, for example, I did some shopping today on my bike. I didn't, you know, we also have a car and it stayed in the spot that I have on the street. Mm-hmm. And I was able to do my shopping today with bags on my bike and get it done. And I know that if there was a safer way to get up and down Queens Boulevard where the bulk of our stores are, that it would be just a boon for business with people feeling safer, being able to use the bike lane and not have to use their car.
Thank you so much for your call. Shamita, we have just 30 seconds left. I know you also did a story this week on why everybody hates cyclists, quote unquote,
yes.
Everybody hates. Just take 20 seconds and tell people how they can hear all of the We the Commuters Bike Week material.
You can go to gothamist.com and search for We the Commuters. You can go to wethecommuters.org and you'll get all the content there. You can also sign up for a newsletter. And I'll leave you with one last word of wisdom from someone at the Dutch Cycling Embassy, which exists. For people who say New York isn't Amsterdam, which I heard a lot over the past couple of weeks of reporting, New York isn't Amsterdam. Well, Amsterdam wasn't Amsterdam 50 years ago. And you can find out more about the history of how Amsterdam has changed a lot over the past 50 years.
Shamita, thanks a lot. And we are, after all, New Amsterdam.
That's right.
And we go out with more music from Joe Young for this great little song. It is this great little song about building a bike lane.
I want some bike lanes in my neighborhood. I'll gather up my cycling friends. The Transportation Committee of the Community Board will hear our great idea and finally then be sent to the Department of Transportation where they hear from the board and then we'll wait and wait and wait and wait some more. The DOT then publicly presents proposals, then the board sees if the plan makes sense. The board then next will hopefully make a vote of yes. And the DOT says we'll get started soon.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.